The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, November 25th, 2019. Wow, damn, this year is going by fast. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Monday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Professor Gene Bajlan from Missouri State University. There are protests happening across the Middle East, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon. Why? What connects those threads? Plus, the betrayal of the Kurds, every day it gets clearer and clearer. It had nothing to do with any type of dismantling of U.S. empire in the Middle East. Those forces have been redeployed to protect oil fields, among other things. We're talking about Turkey's latest moves and the Trumpian delusion across the greater Middle East region. Bolivia's coup government has named former President Evo Morales as a quote-unquote terrorist. Many people freaking out on Twitter that they have agreed to hold elections after waging this coup. But Evo and his party, the legitimate president, cannot run in them. So we are still in a coup footing. That's called a coup.
It's a coup, just simply technically a coup.
It's just a coup. The military, even if they say so nicely, still constitutes a coup. South Bend's prominent African-American leader endorses Joe Biden in a direct rebuke to Pete Buttigieg.
Burn.
New footage of Pete emerges showing that his views of race and education are demented. 13 people have been killed in southern Iraq in the worst days of protests. Reports that potentially over 100 protesters have been killed in Iran. Hong Kong elections see pro-democracy groups make big gains. And Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, castigates the United States. The only thing we did wrong was not back down, which is, in fact, absolutely true. Donald Trump gutting the Iran nuclear deal. WeWork's founder was helping Jared Kushner craft a Mideast peace plan.
So that's why it's so peaceful over
there. That's why it's so peaceful over there. It's the worst company out there. White House turns up emails showing extensive efforts to justify Trump's decision to block Ukraine military aid. And Justice Department watchdogs finds that bias did not taint officials running the FBI probe, but there are errors in the documentation. And is Devin Nunes so touchy because he's involved in all of this stuff personally? Pentagon chief asks Navy secretary to resign over a Navy SEAL case. A Navy SEAL who engaged was accused of war crimes in Iraq, as President Trump has granted pardons to several war criminals in the past several months.
Straight out of central casting, these guys.
University of Brigham Young University, Idaho, has been kicking students out of college if they take Medicaid instead of the campus insurance. Wisconsin governor signs a bill criminalizing pipeline protesters. Massive anti-democratic. And why are Democrats still doing favors to oil companies? Maybe because many of them are also the pawns of oil companies.
Also, I should just say, as the North Dakota correspondent here, there's a massive spill on the Keystone pipeline in North Dakota that is surprisingly bigger than the oil companies originally said it was.
And in related news, the Patriot Act has quietly been ushered back through Congress and reauthorized by Democratic leadership. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. But first, let's go to the UK. It looks like an uphill battle. the right wing of the Labor Party, the Lib Dems, a biased press, a corporate oligarchic class, a one-dimensional fixation on Brexit, even as Jeremy Corbyn has emerged with really the only workable position on Brexit, have really conspired to hurt Labor Party's poll numbers. Even though if you could step back a little bit and think about this a little bit rationally, this Labor Party is the only thing that can save the UK from just full catastrophe. I mean, the UK is already in decline. It is not an empire, obviously. It is also not going to be Singapore or Dubai. Obviously, leaving the EU is a massive own goal, a huge undermining of its strategic position, but it also reflected, of course, the same broad populist anger that can manifest in smart ways or manifest in incredibly destructive, stupid ways. Trump, Brexit, all the rest.
Especially when there's no real left alternative.
There is a real left alternative in the UK. The Labour Party has put forward one of the best manifestos, really, of modern politics. You're talking about incredible plans on housing, climate, labor, wages, and safeguarding the NHS, which will be not only on the chopping block if the Tories get a full majority. I have no doubt that privatization schemes are in the works. So if you want Donald Trump, and believe me, there's a whole bunch of, you don't want to hear about United Healthcare or Oscar or Cigna or any of these other horrifying companies. If you're in the UK and you've managed to not have to deal with any of these to get your healthcare taken care of, believe me, you don't want to vote for Tories or Lib Dems and change all of that. And it's going to take a lot of thoughtfulness and a lot of effort because the deck is stacked in the Tories and the right wing's favor. I don't know why this happens. There's a lot of theories. The BBC and the British press in general has been virulently anti-Corbyn in the most vitriolic, personalized, dishonest, insane, and unhinged terms. I don't know why this happened. It was bizarre. It is a bizarre cut. And Boris Johnson should be getting this question every day because he's absolutely dishonest. He's absolutely reckless. And he absolutely will continue to be. I mean, that's what's incredible. He already has been a disaster as prime minister. He'll continue to be. Check out this clip. This is from the 22nd. I see.
They do 22/11/19.
Yeah, excuse me. I got a little confused there. Yeah, 22nd month of the year. Check this out. This double November.
It does feel like we've had twice as many months this year.
It does.
So, the first one is BBC Question Time from the 22nd, and the second one is BBC News on the 23rd.
But it's the same clip.
Hello, Prime Minister. I'd just like to ask you, how important is it for someone in your position of power to always tell the truth?
I think it's absolutely vital.
So there's laughter at the beginning of the...
Everybody's laughing because Boris Johnson is even known, like, affectionately. I mean, there are a lot of parallels here. Even people, you know, some people find him a super charming liar. Ugh. Everybody knows the guy lies a lot.
Yeah, so we'll play back here.
Was tell the truth?
I think it's absolutely vital.
While the Prime Minister faced questions on trust.
How important is it for someone in your position of power to always tell the truth?
I think it's absolutely vital.
No laughter. So, look, I'm not going to go, you know, full...
I'll just say is like...
It's weird. It's a weird cut.
I edit videos for the Majority Report every day.
Right.
It's very simple just to clip out a split second that might be a little bit more embarrassing for a candidate or not. And like...
You chose to do it.
And you have... When you have constraints for TV, you can just say, oh, well, we needed to mark this down for time, so we got rid of that. But I think they're covering Boris.
No, it's literally 2 seconds. I think they're definitely covering Boris. And the... You know, look... It's a classic case where you have a guy, and I don't think that, you know, he was like a tabloid columnist, and he's a right-wing politician. They have tried to make Jeremy Corbyn as an anti-Semite a thing for years because he has a principled objection to Israeli apartheid. And he said a couple of tone-deaf things. And there's a broader, a few tone-deaf things, not many, frankly. He's also fought against anti-Semitism and racism in all forms for decades.
Yeah, but he liked an unfortunate Facebook photo.
No, you know, right. Versus the dozens of articles that Boris Johnson has put out, which, by the way, like, I don't, you know, yeah, he was a friggin' shock jock tabloid columnist. But this barely gets any attention. And not to mention his actual record of empowering xenophobia, racism, and just pure lies. I mean, this guy was at the front lines of a Brexit campaign that said the all this money that supposedly goes to the EU, yes, it goes to the EU, but it is more than made for up for in terms of the benefits of the UK economically. That can just get turned into the NHS. Please. And now he's saying that he's going to pump all this funds into the NHS. A lot of it is pre-allotted money anyways. And he's fundamentally dishonest. And if you elect him with a clear majority, you're going to have a bad Brexit and you're going to have another round of austerity and all of the xenophobia and right-wing populism and bigotry that goes along with it. So smarten up. Friends don't let friends vote Lib Dem. And there's a unique opportunity with the Labour Party here.
It's just amazing to me. Haven't you learned the lesson about the Lib Dems?
I don't know. Yeah, the Lib Dems under a leader who is certainly more impressive than the current one. And by the way, that just means like not totally. Are you kidding me? It's like, seriously?
I mean, Cameron is historically bad.
No, Clegg is definitely historically
bad. Oh, Clegg. Okay.
Yeah, Nick Clegg. Yeah, right. Cameron was the conservative, but they're the same person.
So the Lib Dems, they're like the centrist Democrats, kind of, right?
If they had gone, I mean, basically the Lib Dems ran in 2009 in a few respects to the left of Labor, because Labor had been moved so far to the right. And then Nick Clegg went into coalition with David Cameron, proceeded to reverse all of their pledges, and was a co-partner for 5 years in like the most ruthless, grotesque austerity cuts that, I mean, they would go pound for pound against any. I mean, they self-greased themselves. Yeah. Without an external, you know, because this is what the Tories want
to
do.
Even though they were allowed to maintain their own currency.
You cucks.
Yes. Even though the Lib Dems were partners every step of the way. And they wouldn't do an emergency partnership with Corbyn to block a no-deal Brexit. They claim to be the force of social toleration and liberalism. They barely even pretend to care about economic issues and justice anymore. They don't admit it, but everybody knows they're to the right on those issues. They're supposedly going to be the voice on pluralism and the rights of the LGBTQ community and so on. But then any Tory defector that wants to join their party, even with the most loathsome anti-gay, anti-immigrant records, they welcome with open arms because they have no center. Ironically, the center has no center in terms of any kind of bearings. They are totally opportunistic. They have no strategy. They have no value set. If they get near to power, it will almost certainly be to empower and partner the Tories. And Nick Clegg would give a John Stuart Mill appreciation speech while he sent millions out of their homes and others to early deaths with Tory cuts. This new leader, I mean, she'll go on like Question Time and say what her like top three favorite Bruno Mars songs are or something. She's literally anybody can raise themselves in stature in their new positions, which she is not. And her background is literally, I think, is a FM radio programmer. And so this is who we want to vote for, a sociopath, Oxford rich boy with a litany of racist, sexist, and, you know, xenophobic charges, who clearly is going to devastate the UK economically and from the perspective of inequality, than a cynical party whose main record in government is partnering with the Tories to radically increase poverty in the UK. And we all need to do this just to prevent a couple of decent Labour Party politicians who desperately want to do a green housing initiative and protect the NHS and don't want to be complete pawns to US empire and occasionally speak out in a human rights issue or two. I feel like Trump. How stupid are these people? How, and he's down by 10 points? How stupid. How stupid. I can't believe it.
Their press is so terrible over
there.
Their
press is horrible. That's true. Don't follow low energy.
Ours is bad, but theirs is definitely worse.
Theirs is really bad. When it comes to preparing your children for the future, there are a few better ways than helping them learn to code. It's easy to get started with Bitbox. Bitbox is a monthly subscription box that teaches real computer coding for kids 6 to 12. Every month, a beautiful set of app creation projects arrives on your doorstep, and each box comes with a new theme, like animals or robots. Kids simply follow the instructions on the project card and type the app's code on the Bitbox website. Within minutes, the kids can build their first working app and play with it on any smartphone or tablet. Now, I should say, I haven't actually, I looked, obviously, because I consider my skill set to be that of probably about a 10-year-old on technology. I played around with it a little bit, got myself my own app going. It's actually really fun, really addictive.
You and Saul should compete.
He would beat me. Our listeners can get $25 off of any Bitbox subscription of 50 or more by going to bitbox.com/majority and entering promo code majority at checkout. That's $25 plus free shipping at bitbox.com/majority. Promo code majority. That's bitsbox.com/majority. Use promo code majority to order Bitbox today. Your kids will love coding. They will love coding, and you'll gift them with important necessary skills for a successful future. Quip wants you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental health. It's simple, that if you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, reliable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has a sensitive sonic vibrations with built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full, even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked strips to help you use just enough. Since Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months, your routine's always right. And yes, shipping is free. Join 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today starting at $25. I love Quip. It is all of the things they said. It's incredibly easy to use. By the way, the floss is not too tough either. It's smooth. You get some tough floss from the drugstore, it's like they're trying to like hang you with it or something. It's like really intense. This floss is smooth. It does the job very well. And of course, for me, I travel a fair amount. I love how easy the Quip is to pack. If you go to quip.com/majority right now, you get your first free refill. That's your first free refill at getquip.com/majority. That's getquip.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Gene Bajelon.
An agenda that I objected to because while I was working on those streets, watching those folks see their jobs shipped overseas, you were a corporate lawyer sitting on the board of Walmart. I was fighting these fights.
$10,000.
Go to Joe.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Gene Bajelon. He's a professor of history at Missouri State University. Gene, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be here again.
Gene, tell me that one more time. My fault. Oh, he's good. Did everybody hear it? Okay, cool. Gene, my bad. You're here. Thanks for being here. There's protests that have been taking place across the Middle East. There's protests that have been taking place across the globe. They're all important. They're all their own stories. I think, in a broad sense, from Haiti to Ecuador to Russia to Hong Kong, to Iraq, it expresses dissatisfaction with prevailing regimes. There's plenty of dissatisfaction with our prevailing regime in all senses in the United States. I think in Latin America is extremely important because I think in some ways it's centering basically the complete failure and decimation wrought by capitalism and neoliberalism. And I think that that's very explicitly centered across Latin America. When we go to the Middle East, we look at Iraq, Iran, and we will get to specifics, but maybe even echoing Sudan. Are we talking, is the same central focus on the capital dimension? Are we also rejecting the sectarian failures? What is happening in these protests writ large, Iraq, Lebanon, Iran?
I think in a general sense, you can sort of link the protests that are going on across the Middle East to sort of a general discontent towards the neoliberal economic order, you know, broadly conceived. So, you know, there are a lot of common ties, I think, common themes that we can find in the Middle Eastern protests and protests in different parts of the world, and more generally, perhaps in sort of political discontent towards establishment elites, not only in the developing world, but also, you know, in the developed world as well. So I think definitely these protests that are taking place in places like Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, part of sort of global trend in politics, sort of anger at the prevailing economic order, anger at political elites. But of course, in the Middle East, you have a number of specificities which give these protests a specific character. So of course, you know, we can talk about the general themes which link these Middle East protests to sort of global trends, and then we can talk sort of about the specifics, about the specific political conditions that exist in each of these countries and how that's shaping the protests that are taking place, what kind of themes are taking central stage in these protests. So, you know, there are definitely a lot of through lines with these protests and protests in other parts of the world. But of course, we have to understand those Middle Eastern specifics and, you know, the specific history of what's happened in the Middle East in recent years in countries like Iraq, where you've had, you know, devastating war, sectarian conflict. And in Iran, where you've had a kind of siege economy since the 1979, and, you know, how that's affected society, demographic changes, you know, younger people growing up, you know, in America, there's this whole OK boomer thing going on. Well, you know, that's also reflected in the Middle East, with where you have, younger populations who are completely disillusioned with the political systems that they're growing up in.
Let's go to Iraq first. What's been happening in the past several months in terms of protests there, and how do they fit specifically in the larger Iraq story, taking it back with, you know, to the Saddam Hussein days, the invasion, the occupation? What's the sectarian dynamics? What is this emerging from? What are the protests about?
Well, the protests began at the beginning of October. And I was actually in Iraq at the time, and I was in Iraqi Kurdistan. There haven't been major protests there, but, you know, a lot of the same conditions that are animating protesters in other parts of Iraq are bubbling under the surface in Iraqi Kurdistan as well. So what we've seen is, you know, people protesting, sort of organic protest, you know, just regular people who are sick of the political order. The Iraqi government has responded to the outbreak of protests across the country in places like Baghdad, but also in smaller towns and other major cities. You know, just yesterday there were protests in Basra in which, five people were killed and hundreds were wounded. And these, the government has responded in some ways with repression, but also with some kind of promises of reforms, cabinet reshuffle, salary cuts to leading, to politicians. But these haven't really stemmed the tide of the unrest. And, you know, the fundamental issue in Iraq is you still have a country which is, you know, economically in dire straits. I think, you know, the official statistics, 13 million people are unemployed, and that's in a population of 40 million. And perhaps that number, you know, is as high as 20 million. So we don't know exactly. And there's also the issue of underemployment or not being able to make enough money to survive. So we've had, you know, protests breaking out. But what's interesting about these new protests is, of course, they reflect, you know, some of the specific conditions that have existed in Iraq since especially since 2003. So you had, you know, the American invasion in 2003, you had the occupation, and you had a political system that was constructed based on sectarian divisions. Now, this sectarian constitution is not sectarian formally. It's not like Lebanon, where there's like formal power sharing agreements between different sectarian groups. But informally, you know, various positions in the government are, you know, handed over to different sectarian groups. So, for example, the president is always a Kurd, and then you have a prime minister who's a Shia and a speaker of the parliament who is Sunni. There's nothing in the constitution that says that has to be the way it is, but that's the way that it's worked out, because when the Americans came in, they basically sort of set up this power sharing arrangement, which means, of course, you know, you have a political elite which, you know, has a vested interest in maintaining this sectarian system, because they can hold on to certain levers of power through their ethnic identity. So sectarian divisions in Iraq, which, you know, weren't invented by the Americans, you know, these divisions have existed in the past, but have definitely been reinforced by the political structures that came into being after the 2003 invasion. And of course, many people in Iraq bought into these sectarian divisions. You know, you had Shias moving towards Shia parties, Sunnis towards Sunni parties, and Kurds moving towards Kurdish political parties. But, you know, people are beginning to get sick of this sectarian politics. You know, one of the interesting things about these protests is that they are explicitly, or at least, you know, important elements of them are explicitly rejecting sectarianism, calling for a change in the regime and a move away from this sort of sectarian orientated system. For example, the Shia majority in the country, you know, many of them are tired of the way that Shia political parties and Shia militias dominate their life. For example, you know, a figure like Muqtada al-Sadr, who was, you know, gained a lot of popularity because of his resistance to the American occupation and as someone who sort of fought against the political establishment. Well, people are tired, you know, merchants, small business people, they're tired of paying, you know, informal protection money, you know, to Muqtada al-Sadr's group in order to maintain his militias. After the war, you know, after ISIS sort of reared its head in 2014, you had the creation of the Popular Mobilization Units, the Heshti Shabir. And this is a kind of militia group, again, highly sectarian, you know, with strong connections to Iran, which is, you know, if you want to think of an analogy, you know, they're kind of positioned like the Revolutionary Guard in Iran. You know, mm-hmm. They're not as powerful, of course, but this group as well, you know, people are tired of it. You know, Iraqis, the majority are Shias, but they too are tired of Iranian influence over their country as well. You know, just as they got tired of American influence over their over the country, they're also tired of Iranian influence. Recently, The Intercept published a large number of diplomatic cables, which demonstrated the sheer extent that the Iranians had influence over Iraqi political parties, not only Shia parties, but, for example, the Kurdish political parties, which developed strong relationships with Iran, especially during the war with ISIS. But these relationships go back a long way. So sectarianism and basically people being sick of the political order in Iran is in Iraq is one major factor behind this. But more generally, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm just on Iraq for one more minute. One of the things that's very interesting to me and very disturbing about the Iraqi example is you have, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost seems like you have this sectarian model exported from Lebanon, essentially. And I actually, you know, I really think some people should look at some of the real dangers and limits of this model You know, in some ways, it can be very important because it can ensure different group interest, which is obviously vital. But it's also really undermined, you know, broadening out democratic institutions and also creating mass-based delivery and dealing with corruption networks. Because there is a whole other part of the story that I think does actually show that across all of these very sharp divisions are a sort of, there's a 1% political class, right? And even if they're battling with each other, sometimes incredibly violently, this works for them. Shia, Sunni, and Kurd, to some extent in Iraq, and, you know, Christian Shia and Sunni in Lebanon to some extent. But that being said, you have this sectarian dimension. Then you also have the other thing that happened to Iraq, which is that first you had the crime of the US-UK invasion, but then you had the next wave of crime, which was the Bush administration's attempt to put Iraq, to make Iraq some type of, you know, market utopia. So tons of people lose their jobs. All of the companies are looted for, you know, American oil companies and tech companies. Obviously, this creates even more crisis and poverty. This is the Naomi Klein shock doctrine stuff. So to what extent today in Iraq are we dealing with an outgrowth? I think you very clearly summarized the sectarian dimension. But what about that shock doctrine dimension as well?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's, you know, bubbling below the surface of these sectarian issues, there is the issue of corruption, which, you know, corruption and privatization go hand in hand.
Right.
The lack of public service. Now, the Iraqi state sector has not entirely been dismantled. You know, the Americans weren't, you know, perfectly able to do all this. And I'd make the argument, actually, that, you know, the main objective of the Iraqi invasion in terms of looting wasn't simply Iraq, but was also like to loot the American treasury mm-hmm. as well. And the Iraqis were the collateral damage of that. But yet we have, you know, we have this move away from sort of the welfareism of the 60s and 70s towards a policy that came to be known in the Arab world as infitah, opening. You know, it began in Egypt, and we see it under Saddam Hussein with this beginning of privatization. But of course, this sort of continues on under the American occupation. So you have, basically Iraq. The Iraqi economy is sort of non-existent, just producing oil, pumping it out of the country, getting foreign money, and then sort of distributing it through patronage networks. And for Iraqi people, you know, it's very hard to, you know, when you go to an election, you know, you want to be able to choose between different parties. And, you know, an analogy I would draw is, you know, people talk about American politics in the 60s and 70s and the fact that the Republicans and Democrats were so close to each other, it was difficult for, you know, for people to like have a real choice in politics because both sides of the political spectrum sort of accepted the same economic consensus and so on and so forth. The same thing is in Iraq. You know, whatever your sectarian background is, whichever party you vote for, they're all participating in this same, economic system. And, you know, the country has terrible public services. Electricity is still not 24 hours a day. And, you know, there were just small issues that drive people crazy. You know, Baghdad is very hot. Now, imagine in the middle of summer, you only have 2 hours of electricity and you don't have fully running water, or you have to go purchase water because the water coming out of the tap will give you dysentery or make you sick at the very least. These things drive people crazy. You know, when I was in Iraq, I spoke to my relatives there. Shout out to Mohammed and Ibrahim. And, you know, they were saying, like, we just feel like there's no opportunity here. Nothing ever gets better. You know, things in Kurdistan are slightly better than in the rest of Iraq because Kurdistan wasn't, you know, hit by that violence. But, you know, just the daily necessities of life are very difficult. You know, in large parts of Iraq, you just can't survive. You know, it's 45 degrees centigrade and you're in your house sweating. There's no jobs. And the only way that you get jobs is through connections. So,
right.
People see the sons and daughters of the sort of political elite, you know, traveling around the world, going to New York, going to the West, and they're still like sort of stuck trying to deal with those basic necessities of life, which is extremely difficult for them to deal with. And, you know, it's you know, very often what triggers people into action is this sort of daily grind that they have to go through. And, you know, after nearly, well, you know, a decade and a half, it seems, you know, nothing is moving, or at least it's moving so slowly. And every time there seems to be a little bit of a progress, it sort of falls back down on them. So there's a lot of sort of anger and helplessness that's now sort of exploded into anger. And, you know, we have these protests, which are sort of organic. There are different, you know, it doesn't seem to be like highly directed. It's not directed by political parties. There is a, you know, I would recommend to your listeners, there are two excellent pieces published by Ansar Jassim, who's an activist in Tahrir Square in Baghdad at the moment, and Shluva Sama. They published a piece in Open Democracy and a piece in Jacobin, you know, discussing some of the issues that, you know, people in Iraq are facing. The poor in Iraq, the vast majority of people are living in this kind of this nightmare system where they don't feel that there's any opportunity for them to advance.
Going to Iran, and I, before we actually get into this, I mean, I think this is worth noting, and let's stipulate right out of the gate. I mean, two kind of general questions, but let's stipulate, of course, the Iranian regime has a very repressive internal security apparatus that people who have wanted greater openness and freedom, even in a, you know, quote unquote, non-Western sense, have objected to, including national leaders like President Khatami, who's been severely sidelined, right? And also, you know, that, of course, there is an ongoing and very aggressive effort from other powers, primarily the United States, to destabilize Iran, whether it be through, you know, just a relentless sanctions regime, which threatens a lot of Iranian people's lives, threats of war, and undoubtedly, you know, it would be naive and delusional to think that there wasn't, you know, covert action as well. So that in context, though, balancing that out, obviously there's a huge amount of dissatisfaction in Iran, and not least of which economic. Iran actually has one of the highest Gini coefficients in the world, which is fascinating because the Iranian constitution, which emphasizes Islam and anti-imperialism, also has a very strong social justice component, and arguably more success on the sort of on the anti-imperial and Islam component, very little on the justice component, with some reforms by Rouhani on healthcare and other things. He's kind of the Iranian Obama in a way. But putting that all on the table, I mean, what do you make of that, just big picture, before we get to the events of the last couple of weeks, in terms of what's actually driving what's happening in Iran? I mean, does this echo the labor protests that happened a year or so ago?
I mean, yes, I would, again, sort of reiterate your point. It is possible to sort of oppose American sanctions or American military intervention in Iran without sort of making the Islamic Republic into some kind of socialist, anti-imperialist utopia. You know, I think there is sometimes a tendency on certain elements on the American political left to, you know, romanticize these deeply oppressive regimes. But, you know, we can sort of walk and chew bubblegum at the same time, recognizing, you know, American policy. Well, not only is it sort of immoral or, you know, dangerous, it actually in some ways serves to strengthen these authoritarian regimes. But yes, you know, in a general sense, we've had labor protests in Iran. We've had ethnic protests in Iran. And, you know, this latest wave of protests is, again, sort of part of that sort of general discontent towards the existing political economy of Iran, the way that the economy is structured, who benefits. And again, this sort of elite that rules over the country, like in Iraq, where you have a political class, which, you know, which somebody once described it to me as the worst political class in the Middle East. But, you know, Iran has a political class which is very good at statecraft, has a long tradition of statecraft, have been very successful in executing sort of foreign policy. But domestically, you know, things have not really improved very much. And, you know, we have a long tradition of shifting towards austerity in Iran. You know, just as Saddam Hussein, you know, the privatizations began under Saddam Hussein, you know, we see hardliners, the so-called hardliners, and particularly during the presidency of Ahmadinejad, you know, moves towards sort of more neoliberal economics. And in fact, President Rouhani in 2010 published a book, National Security and the Economic System of Iran, in which, you know, he very much sort of came on board with the sort of neoliberal economic consensus, decrying sort of oppressive labor laws, which make it difficult for businesses to thrive, talking about the freedom of capital so that small businesses and business people can be entrepreneurs, and so sort of pioneered this authoritarian version of neoliberalism in the economy, which, you know, has not really benefited the Iranian people. And so, you know, the trigger for these latest protests was a 200% price hike in the in petrol. Now, petrol, you know, a lot of commentators have said, oh, well, you know, petrol is already subsidized in Iran, you know, it's cheap. So, you know, they've sort of framed this as ending subsidies. But, you know, for most Iranian people, you know, they're suffering from inflation, they're suffering from the fact that, you know, they have to buy things that are sold in dollars using the Iranian currency, the rials, which, you know, are not very valuable as well. So you have sort of, again, this, you know, sort of neoliberalism. And of course, you know, to bring it back to the Naomi Klein shock doctrine, the excuse for this is that, well, the sanctions are putting pressure on the economy, so we need to hike these prices in order to sort of pay, you know, pay for social welfare for poor people, which people don't buy. People don't buy that because they see the corruption of the regime. You know, I think we've mentioned it before. They have this, they had these Instagram accounts, I believe, which were, you know, rich kids of North Tehran versus South Tehran. So right. North Tehran is the wealthy region and South Tehran is the poor region. And, you know, you have these people living in luxury in one part of the city and in poverty in the other part of the city. And these people are all connected to officials in the regime who have access to the military, the economic resources that the regular population does not have access.
Can I ask you? Well, let me, I want to, I don't know if it's a pushback exactly. I mean, it's not a pushback in the sense that it's undoubtedly true. And you can get into, you know, look into the personal finances even of some prominent members of the Iranian government and the Instagram accounts. And the disparity is there. The disparity is there literally as in any other capitalist country, without a doubt. And we're also going to get to the reports of the killings and repression from the Iranian security services in a moment. But on the other hand, I think what I don't want to miss here, though, is that it's one thing if a government is under aggressive sanctions and the elite still reward themselves at the expense of a general population to some extent. That's undoubtedly happening. At the same time, the sanctions are so systemic and so relentless to the point of, you know, people are not getting their cancer medications. You know, airplanes are not getting upgraded, so their fleets are more likely to crash. To what? I mean, I guess my point being is like, great, you shouldn't buy it from the, you know, from any government when they say that, right? But just as in, you know, is an extreme example, but I mean, and they have far less power as a kind of middle rank power than Iran. But if you go to, you know, if you look at the demonstrations in Haiti as an example, there's a very deep understanding that, of course, the prevailing political system in Haiti and the political leaders, many of them are discredited and corrupt and venal and so on. But the whole system is predicated on a U.S., in that case, I mean, a literal colonial IMF, World Bank, U.S. presence, right? Now, Iran, obviously, is a far more powerful country. It doesn't have that same type of U.S. overrealm, but it does have relentless sanctions, which in a de facto way, the Europeans are following. The Chinese and the Russians give some business, but it's not enough to sort of make up for it. So not in terms of the response or the corruption of the Iranian government, which I think we can clearly both agree on, but in terms of the scale of the undermining of the Iranian economy and what's driving it, I mean, it seems to me hard that you wouldn't center the sanctions in that at this point because they're so systemic.
No, I mean, I'm, yeah. I, I, the sanctions have, you know, been disastrous for the country. You know, there's no doubt about that. But I think and, you know, people, you know, I don't think there's, at least among many people in Iran, I don't think there's, you know, any illusions about the United States. There will be certain people who look to it. But of course, people are angry because there are people within the regime who benefit from sanctions. You know, if you have access to cheap dollars subsidized by the government, you can buy up the property and lands of people who don't have access to that money. So, you know, there are people who are able to actually profiteer off these things. So, of course, you know, the sanctions, you know, what I'm not trying to take away from the sanctions, but they've exacerbated and brought to crisis point a prevailing economic situation in the country. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are disappointed that, you know, the deal didn't go through, and now the Americans have reversed on it, and they're continuing living in this nightmare. And meanwhile, at the same time, they look and they see the Iranian government spending resources on, you know, military adventures overseas, which may have a logical national security reason from the Iranian government's perspective, particularly sort of due to its geopolitical situation. But, you know, for your average Iranian, they're asking, why are we spending resources in all these other countries when things at home are in such a dire straits? And I think one of the, you know, so obviously I don't want to take away from the impact of the sanctions on the country, which have made things worse. And from another perspective, they forced the regime to close ranks. You know, at the end of the day, just, you know, to draw an analogy, one of the biggest sort of boosts for the Islamic Republic in its early years was the American-backed Iraqi invasion. It allowed the Iranian regime to consolidate power over its population, to repress oppositions, all in the name of defending the country against external aggression. At the same time, the sanctions play into the hands of these hardliners who are able to mobilize a significant portion of the population around Iranian nationalism and sort of basically portray those people protesting as being the stooges of the CIA or the stooges of the Mujahideen Khalq, this weird opposition group that's backed by people like Bolton. So, you know, the sanctions in some ways have a very counterproductive role if you're hoping to see a democratization or a better regime in Iran, because they, you know, force that regime to sort of close ranks and adopt a more hardline policy.
Yeah, I mean, and even that, just the MEK, it's such a perfect example, though, of like U.S., all of these regime change lunatics like Bolton, you know, the conduit is this like terrorist cult type of group, you know, with all sorts of accusations and allegations against them going back to the 80s, including them, you know, participating on the side of Iraq during the Iraq-Iran war, and sort of universal contempt across all Iranian factions. And this is who Bolton and Giuliani and Howard Dean and, you know, a bunch of people who, I mean, probably in some cases just got paid to speak for, you know, just it was just a good speaking gig. But before we go off of Iran, I mean, the reports are that a lot of demonstrators have been killed in the last several days. What do we know about that?
Well, you know, information has been sporadic coming from Iran because the Iranian government shut off the internet. I think they reopened it today, but they've shut off the internet to the country, obviously learning from the Green Movement and how those protests are played out. You know, the violence, we're seeing numbers of between 100 or 200 people killed since November the 15th. And the repression certainly seems to be a lot worse than the repression faced by the Green Movement, because you have protests across the country in Tehran, Shiraz, Isfahan, Qazvin, Tabriz, as well as smaller cities. And, you know, in the periphery of the country, in those regions, in Kurdistan, in Khuzestan, the Arab populated region, and in Balochistan, state violence is, state violence against these protests comes on top of, you know, already significant repression. And, you know, it looks in certain ways that the Iranians have sort of adopted Assad-type tactics to kind of deploy more violence against the periphery regime in order to divide the movement and things like this. But as I said, previously, the regime, the division between reformist and hardliner is a lot less today because you know, they feel the pressure and they need to, you know, maintain power. And, you know, a lot of people are hoping that the, you know, that this will end in the overthrow of the regime. I am not particularly hopeful for it because, you know, the regime still has a reservoir of support and it still has a strong military, and they are repressing, you know, they're willing to use violence to repress these protests. You know, it's, you know, some people, are, like I said, are calling these protests, you know, CIA inspired, but actually they're organic, and that's one of their weaknesses in some way, because there's no sort of clear, you know, clear objective for these movements, no alternative system. So the regime just closes ranks and represses them and hopes that the problems will go away.
And then when the CIA tries to come and organize them, become a disaster. I mean, that's sort of what the lesson is, right? Is you do have these organic people don't want to acknowledge that. That's a problem. And then there is the CIA element, and then that becomes just a sort of, you know, CIA Gulf oil project.
And I mean, the nightmare is that Iran could degenerate into something like Syria, but, you know, in a country of 80 million people. That's the big danger. That's the big danger for these protests. You know, that's
your
the big
phone
danger.
Agrees. Gene, we only have a couple more minutes, but I do want to touch on northern Syria and Turkey. It's been several weeks since the pullout, maybe more importantly, several weeks since a deal between the Syrian Kurds and Bashar al-Assad. And then also this sort of ongoing dance, primarily between Turkey and Russia, with the United States in the periphery looking to guard oil interests, you know, as they all are in different degrees. But what's happening now?
Well, you know, the offensive is still taking place. It kind of lost a bit of momentum. But, you know, just today there were reports that Ayn al-Issa is under attack. It's a town in which there's a lot of refugees that have been displaced from this border region. So, you know, the fighting in northern Syria continues, mainly with this sort of Turkish-backed militia group, which is, you know, causing human rights abuses and is clearing out the region, not just of Kurds, but also of Christians and other religious minorities. So we have this kind of, you know, we have an ongoing conflict. Meanwhile, Turkey is being very successful at sort of playing different sides against one another. You know, Turkey, for its domestic audience, is sort of portraying itself as this, you know, almost fighting America in fighting the invading Syria and, you know, being this Islamic power. It's also sort of making overtures to Russia, but when Erdogan came to Washington, he sort of mobilizes his discourse that we're an ally in the fight against terrorism, and the Kurds in Syria are run by terrorists, so we're fighting those groups. So, you know, Erdogan is playing, you know, a very successful game overseas in managing all these different factors, which makes these different factions, which makes his position quite strong. And, you know, Trump has, you know, acquiesced to a lot of Erdogan's demands. I don't know why, because, you know, a lot of people around him are actually quite hostile to Turkey, but he maintains like this strong relation with Erdogan. And then, you know, inside Turkey, we're seeing ongoing political repression. So opposition voices are being repressed in the country, people who are against the war. And of course, the HDP, Kurdish political parties, their officials across the country are still being removed.
Can you talk a little bit about, these are very important, the HDP, we've talked about it before, but can you give people just a minute? I mean, it's a very important political party, and now under Erdogan, some of the most important political prisoners on earth.
Yeah, I mean, we have the leader of the party, Selahattin Demirtas, who's still, you know, still imprisoned by the Turkish government. And, you know, his political party is being, you know, forced out. And one of the important things about, you know, what's going on in Turkey, about how this war affects Turkish internal politics, is that, you know, prior to the offensive, there was a kind of rapprochement between the People's Republican Party, the Republican People's Party, the main opposition party, and the HDP to sort of form a united front against the AKP, which
is Erdogan's party.
Which is Erdogan's party. And this rapprochement resulted in the election of an opposition mayor in Istanbul and in Ankara. This war now has sort of forced people to pick a side. And of course, many CHP people, there are a few honorable exceptions, such as the leader of the CHP in Istanbul, Canan Kaftanoglu, who have opposed the war, but many of them have signed off on this. So this has made that rapprochement, that sort of unified front against Erdogan internally, difficult. At the same time, Erdogan is mobilizing all kinds of sort of deeply racist rhetoric towards Kurds. For example, he said, well, the region that we're occupying in Syria is not suitable for Kurds because Kurds live in mountains and this is sort of flatlands and deserts, so it should be for the Arabs. So they want to basically, and they're sort of rounding up Syrians, these Syrian refugees, and trying to deport them. Now, I don't think they've started deporting them to this safe zone that they've created, but, you know, they're invading Syria, they're establishing Turkish language schools, institutions, and things like that, and sort of imposing their guise on that as a prelude to hopefully, this is Erdogan's stated goal, to basically put, you know, 2-3 million Syrians in that territory and completely, you know, it's really striking. You know, Erdogan has like openly stated his goal is to sort of ethnically cleanse the region and put Arabs in that region who are from different parts of Syria. And, you know, this is ethnic cleansing and even genocide to a certain degree. And, you know, the world is like pretty much doing nothing about it. Now, Trump, you know, talked about like withdrawing from these forever wars. But, you know, the reality is, you know, he's just handing over this region to a NATO ally, allowing ethnic cleansing to take place, keeping control of the oil in a very naked way, you know, keeping troops on that. So he didn't even withdraw from Syria, and then acting as a mercenary force for the Saudis. So, right. You know. Trump often plays on sort of liberal hypocrisy, but, you know, people who think that this withdrawal is a withdrawal or anything to do with sort of winding down the American imperial footprint in the world, are really, you know, I think they're clowning about.
Gene Bajelan, I can't even ask the follow-up question because that's too perfect a way to end. Gene Bajelan, professor of history at Missouri State University, of course, frequent contributor on the TMBS Illicit Histories. Gene, thanks a million as always.
Hey, thanks so much. And you take care of yourself,
take
Michael.
Care. All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half where we've got some sound to get through and some other business before we take our leave. I had a very full weekend, as did Matt. Coming back from Philly, and then a great event at the Jackman on Friday, or no, not at Verso Books Friday night. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. And of course, today's show was also brought to you by Bitbox. Bitbox is a monthly subscription box that teaches real computer coding for kids ages 6 to 12. Within minutes, kids can build their first working app and then play with it on any smartphone or tablet. Get $25 off any Bitbox subscription of 50 or more by going to bitbox.com/majority report, entering promo code majority at checkout. That's $25 off and free shipping at bitbox.com/majority, promo code majority. That's bitsbox.com/majority, and use promo code majority to order Bitbox today. Your kids will love coding and you'll gift them with important skills necessary for a successful future. Tonight, we are actually doing TMBS instead of Tuesday. Illustrious guest Nina Turner, and then Milton Alamadi, the great Milton Alamadi in studio. We're going to be talking about, in the commentary, Achille Abimbe, how neoliberalism birthed the far right, and can we reverse the end of the age of humanism? Then Nina and I are going to talk about Walmart workers and a whole bunch more, maybe even clown on the ever odious Pete Buttigieg. And then Milton is going to come in and we're going to talk about what NATO did to Libya, what's happening in Uganda. Of course, we've got to debunk a whole bunch more. Thanks to everybody who came out to Philly. Patreon.com/TMBS. Get the whole thing. Check out the Sunday episode with Drew Mikael from the ground in Beirut. What is happening there? And this Sunday, Megan Day on how the Green New Deal actually happens and housing justice for all, the incredible work of Bernie Sanders, AOC, and Ilhan Omar. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, patreon.com/TMBS. Jamie, what's up?
How can I ever compete with that? Well, I'll try.
Try. Competition would start kicking in.
We all travel in our own lane here and lift each other up. I love Nina Turner.
She is my fave.
So, this week on the Antifada, Sean and Andy go to the UK to suck some cans with the lads and lass of England's only podcast, Trash Future. Very funny podcast if you've never listened to it. They discuss the upcoming elections, the deep insecurities at the center of posh life, which are motivating Boris Johnson's political career, the Lib Dem and Chuck Cucks, and Corbyn's cheeky plan to nationalize Nando's and put Mr. Bean on the dole or whatever. And I only understood some of that. But if you want to understand all the wacky politics going on in the UK, check it out. They also released a bonus for our patrons on Friday. It is a real Lib Dem hours. Indeed. God, still with suck. Trash Future. And they lead Sean and Andy in a reading of James Kirkup's dystopian fanfic, How the Lib Dems Could Seize Power.
Ugh.
They clown on that pretty well.
That's horrible.
Bunch of funny guys. Check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover. Most recent episode is on a bit of prose fiction called Orinoco or The Royal Slave by Afra Ben. It's prose fiction on, I mean, I don't want to call it a novel. It's a very short story dealing with themes of colonialism, slavery, race, and aristocracy, published by a woman and in 1688. Which is to say it's not exactly woke, but it is interesting that it deals with all those things. And we discuss it. So patreon.com/literaryhangover. Or Literary Hangover, wherever you get your podcasts, or most places you get your podcasts.
All right, folks, we will see you on the fun half. I guess we will see you on the fun half. We'll see you on the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.